Welcome back. I'm in for Steve Kraske, and you're probably already thinking about Thanksgiving. I know I am. It's probably the most traditional of holidays, but green bean casserole, pumpkin pie, stuffing are a modern take on Thanksgiving that, well, were unheard of when the Pilgrims shared a meal with Native Americans back in the early 1600s. Today, a lesson on what real Native American indigenous food is like from someone who is here to tell us to consider participating in the 10th annual Week of Indigenous Eating. And save those green beans and pumpkin pie for another time. Joining me now on Up to Date, Devin Mahiso, the Cora Lee Beers Price Professor in the Humanities Program at the University of Kansas, an enrolled citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, and author of Recovering Our Ancestors' Gardens, Indigenous Recipes, and Guide to Diet and Fitness. Devin, you probably need a Thanksgiving break more than I do. Tell me about the first Thanksgiving meal.
Well, you know, there are so many versions of the first Thanksgiving, and the idea is that the pilgrims and Indians someplace in the Northeast sat down together and had a massive feast. And the idea is that they live peacefully side by side. And the Indians even help the pilgrims survive by showing them how to plant corn and what to gather. It's a specific concept because the image is of befeathered Indians sitting at a table with hat-wearing pilgrims politely passing around bowls of candied yams. But it's at the same time a vague concept because most people don't know where this took place, nor do they know the tribes involved. They don't know what foods were available or how the people behaved. Now, the people involved were the Wampanoags on Cape Cod, and they came to investigate what the pilgrims were up to after they heard shots being fired. And the pilgrims were celebrating their harvest, because up until this point, they had had a very difficult time growing food. So as the Wampanoags tell it, there were around 90 natives and half that of pilgrims. And the natives were not invited to this. They just, you know, stayed around to partake in the harvest. And so they went to the forest and they brought back some deer that would have been roasted probably. There was no pecan, pumpkin, or apple pie with whipped cream or ice cream, no peanut brittle, no green bean casserole with crunchies, no mashed potatoes with gravy or wheat rolls, because wheat, beef, chicken, pigs, buttercream, eggs, and so forth are not indigenous to this hemisphere, and tribes didn't eat them. They may have had turkey, but that is only because turkey lived in the area. We don't know that for sure. Definitely, they probably had seafood because they were on, you know, Cape Cod. Squash would have been roasted. And the corn would not have been the yellow sweet corn that we know and like today, because yellow sweet corn is a GMO. Product. This would have been earthy and not eaten on the cob, because preparing corn is not a fast process. In order for corn to be nutritious, and this is what the Wampanoags had to teach the pilgrims, is to soak the kernels in wood ash, because this would chemically alter the corn to release amino acids. Because if you have a deficiency of amino acid lysine, this leads to the lack of niacin, and you could develop pellagra. So this was a very important lesson to, you know, for them to learn. So the point is that the corn would have been a mush, and maybe some meat was added to it, and they would not have sat at the table either. There were just too many people. So they probably just stood around, and then whatever was ready off the fire is what they ate.
You know, I'm ready to learn something about the Indigenous Eating Week next week, and then I want you to start talking to me about your favorite recipes. But first, let's start with Indigenous Eating Week. Tell me about that.
Well, I started this about 10 years ago, and this is on my Facebook page, Indigenous Eating. And I also manage the American Indian Health and Diet Project at the University of Kansas. So there's information on it on that page as well. But I started this to honor Martin Reinhart. He's a friend of mine. He's an Anishinaabe and professor at Northern Michigan who started the Decolonizing Diet Project. And he decided about 10, 12 years ago that he and a few colleagues would eat only pre-contact foods for an entire year. So I became advisor to this project, and they did it. And it took a year to organize. It was not easy. This is quite impressive feat. And so my challenge, because his is a bit too arduous, is to eat only foods either from your tribe or other U.S. tribes or pre-contact foods from the whole hemisphere. And you might have to expand your range and include the whole hemisphere because a lot of our foods are either not available anymore or they're very expensive. And so this year, it's going to be the same as I have done in the past. And I will post the dishes, food photography. I would post those and tell you how I made it. And so it's the goal to keep these things simple and to get people inspired about learning about their foods.
What's not available anymore or what's too expensive?
Well, not everybody has access to elk or moose. Salmon, with the exception of farmed salmon, which is a lot cheaper than wild salmon, people just can't afford a lot of these things that we used to eat. And a lot of these items are very specific to area. So down here, where we live in Kansas, we're not going to be hunting moose. If you want moose, you're going to have to spend some money. You have to be a hunter. You have to have the equipment, et cetera. And then there's the big problem with climate change and global warming. A lot of the foods that we used to gather have disappeared or greatly diminished. A lot of the things that we may have gathered in the past, like pinon nuts in the Southwest. For me, I like to gather pawpaws and mulberries, wild onions. A lot of these things are on private land, so you can't just hop the fence, and go take somebody's things. So that can be a problem. And again, a lot of people, particularly with COVID right now, and people losing their jobs, economically speaking, they just don't have the budget to buy things.
So your latest book, Recovering Our Ancestors' Gardens, just came out with a new edition this month, and it has a lot of indigenous recipes. But you have two different versions of recipes in there, an old world and a new world version. Tell me what the difference is.
Well, we have to keep in mind that the way foods were traditionally prepared were very simple. They didn't look like the beautiful plates that our indigenous chefs prepare today. Foods would have been just roasted over the fire. Maybe they were put in a pot, or you just ate it as you gathered it. And also, they didn't have access to spices such as garlic, the things that colonizers brought over with them. So what I have done, and you can also see this in the recipes on my American Indian Health and Diet page, is I will put an asterisk by some of the ingredients of the recipes because, a lot of people really want butter on their food. They want butter and they need chicken. But a lot of these traditional foods, even some Native people don't really like it. They want cheese on it. So that is why I make some modern riffs, I guess, to make them appealing.
Yeah. Cheese is a very forgiving ingredient. It can take almost any dish and make it palatable. Do you have a favorite recipe in the book, or one that you make every time this time of year?
Yes. My go-to recipe really is it's squashes. And it's a conglomerate that I put in my iron skillet. It's squashes, sweet potatoes, onions, tomatoes, and peppers. And I use grapeseed oil. And then I let that cook until it's very soft. And, you put whatever you like on top of that. Usually it's just a little salt and pepper. And I make that multiple times a week. And so this is a staple in our house. And the other thing you can do with that dish is you can put it into your food processor with the kind of broth that you might like, whether it's, vegetable broth or chicken broth. And then you process it and you can make a soup out of it. And the other one that I really like to make a lot, because I grow a lot of butternut squashes, is I prepare the squash in that same way and then put that in the food processor, and then you can make your squash soup. And that's a really good dish for Thanksgiving because it fills you up so you don't, you know, eat too much of everything else if you're concerned about overeating. Another one that I make, and my children like this even growing up, is just a basic baked sweet potato. And I like them with just a little bit of black pepper on top. But another way you can do it, if you want a little more stuff on top, is to drizzle maple syrup on it. I also add roasted green chilies and balsamic vinaigrette. So that's one of my favorite comfort foods. But I think my favorite out of the book is blue corn pancakes. And that's a very simple one. You would need blue cornmeal. And I also add mesquite flour to that. And I mix in chia seeds and strawberry mash or any kind of fruit mash that you might like, and walnuts, vanilla, and agave nectar into the batter. And then I put that on the griddle. So it already has the sweetness and the toppings mixed in. But that recipe is in the book, and it's also on my webpage, Indigenous Eating.
So I'm assuming there was no balsamic vinaigrette at the first Thanksgiving.
No.
So what I'm hearing here is a mashup of old and new, and I have to say that I'm liking it. I'm liking it very much.
Well, you know, you want to take the very best of what the world has to offer. But I'm also very active in the Indigenous food sovereignty movement. And one thing that is very important to those of us in the movement is that we really understand what were our pre-contact foods, because they were very specific to our homelands. So by reconnecting with those foods that your tribe did eat historically and saving seeds and understanding ceremonies associated with those foods, you have a connection to your culture, which instills pride. And another goal of this week of Indigenous Eating is for people to revisit all of that information about their tribes, because as you probably know, Native people are suffering from unprecedented health problems related to food, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity. And one way to solve this is to get back out gardening and gathering and revisiting these foods that really did nourish Native people for millennia.
You know, in the New York Times, you talked about pawpaw, and you mentioned it earlier in our interview. And I have to say that I am pawpaw ignorant. So get me up to tell me about that.
Yes, pawpaw is a fruit, and pawpaw really has taken off. People are really showing great interest in pawpaws, but not everybody knows what it is, because pawpaws don't grow everywhere in the United States. Pawpaws probably were on Cape Cod, so it's conceivable that definitely they were up there gathering them. But pawpaws are, they grow to be, big ones are about the size of a baked potato, and they have the ones that are ripe have the texture kind of like a banana mango, but pawpaws, they have a very short shelf life. The ideal pawpaw is one that just fell off the tree into your hand and you eat it right there, because they ripen very, very quickly. And some of the best tasting pawpaws look pretty terrible. They look almost, once they start to ferment, they look like a black banana. So it depends on how you feel about eating black bananas. But pawpaws are extremely sweet. And, you know, I just love them. I've always loved them. And after that piece ran in the New York Times, it was interesting. I got some emails from people around the country saying, please send me some. We can't ship them because they just do not last. And they're super delicate. But yeah, they're a wonderful food. And I think they may be making a comeback. But their range only extends really about out to, say, north-south with a line through Lawrence. But I think people in other parts of the country are making an attempt to grow them.
Where do I get them here?
Well, the season has passed. It's really in October. And, you know, I went out foraging this year and I didn't find as many as I normally did because we had a hard freeze and that killed a lot of the blossoms. So you might, if you don't know where to find them, and if you're not really keen on going out and tromping around to gather, you might find them at farmers markets at our little store in Baldwin City, there are some people who have pawpaw trees on their property, and they will bring them into the market. But again, if you don't know what they are, you think, wow, that looks really bruised. I don't even want to try it. So sometimes they just sit there. But if you know what they are, you would grab them quickly.
So if I was looking for a profession outside of radio, growing pawpaws, would that be possible? Can you make a living doing that? Because this is sounding actually quite appealing to me.
Well, that would be very seasonal, because even if you started today, you planted your seed, those little suckers are just very temperamental. And from seed to fruit, it could be from 7 to 8 years before you actually see a fruit. So I do know that some people take cuttings from pawpaw forests, I guess, and they get a head start. But you would only, like I said, you'd only have a very short period of time to sell your fruit, and you would really need to have a market for it. So I would recommend, if you're going to do that, you want to have other things to sell alongside, probably.
All right. So I'm going to have to work on that business plan a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the indigenous food sovereignty movement that you have in your book. But before we get to that, you know, you mentioned that we don't have elk and moose around here, but what we do have around here is venison. And I want to talk to me about a couple of venison recipes, if you can even find it commercially, which I think is pretty hard. But if you can, what do you like to do with it?
Well, first I would say that there probably are elk in West Kansas. So it'd be moose that would be more difficult for you to locate. But elk, again, they are going to be a little scarce. Well, my husband gets deer on the family allotment. He is Comanche in southern Oklahoma. So we do get a lot of venison. And when we do have the animals processed, we have steak, summer sausage, and hamburger. But keep in mind that venison, regardless of the type of venison we're talking about, it has less fat than beef. So you really have to be careful with how you prepare it, because it will dry out very quickly. Same as a wild turkey. Wild turkey will dry out very quickly too. So you need to cook that in like a cooking bag probably. But what I like to do, I make a lot of stews with the venison. If I have a steak, I just do a very quick pan sear, but we always use a lot of green chilies and dried tomatoes, and just a lot of vegetables go in with that. And yes, I do have some recipes for venison in there.
You know, one of my best friends when I was in high school, his mom would make a venison sausage that to this day I still long for. But what I'm hearing you say, if you're going to make hamburgers or if you're going to make sausage, we're going to need to add a little extra fat into that.
Well, that's if you take your animal into be processed and you ask for summer sausage, they will add fat. And sometimes it's pork fat, sometimes it's beef fat. It depends on how you feel about both of those and the quality of the fat that's being added. So this go around, he got a deer just last week, and so I requested no fat. So we're going to see how that turns out, but that's not to everybody's taste. I'm just real sensitive to, you know, that taste of fat. I don't particularly like it, but a lot of people do. But I do like the spices that go into it, right, for sure.
Let's pivot back to the indigenous food sovereignty movement. We talked a little bit about it a few minutes ago, but I want to go a little bit deeper in that. So tell me what that is and how you're involved.
Well, this term food sovereignty, this term came about in 2007 at an international food summit in Mali. And what that is, food sovereignty is the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agricultural systems. So the term indigenous food sovereignty came about right about at that same time. And so I would say that indigenous food sovereignty means the same thing, but the term is kind of awkward, because if you know anything about that term sovereignty, a sovereign nation has complete control over every aspect of its politics, its economics, and its land base, but tribes are domestic dependent nations. So basically what we're dealing here is with a semantics problem, but we still use the term indigenous food sovereignty because tribes really need to have control over their food, how they plant it and how they cultivate it and how they distribute it. There are many food deserts on tribal lands, and a food desert means that you have to drive a very long way if you want to find food at a grocery store. And even if you do find a grocery store, it may have subpar offerings, you know, not very nutritious foods. So even though we just started using this term indigenous food sovereignty, this concept has been around as long as tribes have existed. We have always needed to control our resources, to protect our resources, our water, to protect the environment. And taking care of the natural world is a foundational element of this food sovereignty movement, because once you start treating food as a commodity, that you're going to use these resources because you want to make money, this is when we really run into trouble, because our natural world, as anybody can see right now, is starting to fall apart. And animals are migrating north because it's getting so hot. Water is an issue. And we're not seeing as many fish, as many, you know, much seafood. We're getting to a crisis level. So this indigenous food sovereignty movement is something that is growing by the day. And if anybody's interested, you can just look this up online. And we've got more websites, more blogs, more food summits. Native people are starting their own farming business. They're doing more community work. So it's a movement that people are extremely passionate about. And I should tell you that in between this time, my book came out and the new edition of Recovering Our Ancestors' Gardens, I edited a book with Elizabeth Hoover, Indigenous Food Sovereignty in the United States. And that just recently won the Austin Award for the Society for Economic Botany and the Gourmand International Food and Wine Award for the best indigenous book in the world. So people are getting a lot of use out of that one as well.
So you think that we're moving in a direction that is positive, where we're going to start seeing healthier eating because of this movement?
I think what we're seeing are more people who are interested in this and are very determined to make it happen. There are more people voting. There's more people holding their tribal councils responsible. You know, we need to have, we must protect our resources. We must protect our land. And we need to have national leadership that is going to take care of our climate and our air and our water. So, you know, the question that you're asking, it's a hope that things are moving in the right direction, but we can only do so much, because this all does come down to money and economics and politics. And that is why we really do need to get involved as much as we can. It's not just growing a little garden or eating beautiful food that a chef prepares. You really have to get down and dirty into all aspects of our society in order for us to become healthy and to make sure we're going to have enough food, not just for us, but for future generations.
Devin Mahiasua, thanks for being with us today. She's the author of Recovering Our Ancestors' Garden, Indigenous Recipes, Guide to Diet and Fitness.